Okay, we'll bring Senate Finance to order today. We have quite a few items we want to try to get to. With us thus far, Senator Hoffman, Senator Dunleavy, Senator Bishop, and Vice Chair Senator Fairclough. So the first item we'll take up is House Bill 129. We heard this several times now, and I think members wanted some additional time to review some of the legal reports that we've been getting. Senator Hoffman, did you have a comment on this?
No comments, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Anybody else on House Bill 129? Okay. Senator Fairclough?
Mr. Chairman, I move from committee the CS for House Bill Number 76, Finance 28-GH.
Not 76, 129.
So sorry. I'm getting ahead of it.
You
got a stack. I'm sorry. There we go. One fiscal note, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, zero. Or no. There's 134,000.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to direct the committee's attention to the fiscal note. There's only one. It is labeled fiscal note number 2. It's to the Department of Natural Resources. It's allocation to oil and gas, OMB component number 439. For FY 2014, the request is $134,000 of general fund. Mr. Chairman, I move the CS for House Bill number 129, Finance 28-GH1970-U from committee with attached fiscal note and individual committee recommendations.
Okay. Any objections? Seeing here none, bill moves from committee. All right, let's take a brief at ease. All right, Senate Finance is back. I want to welcome Senator Olson to the Finance Committee as well.
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Senator Kelly is getting ready for the next meeting at 4 o'clock, the Conference Committee, so he may not be here. Okay, so here's the plan. We'll take up 76, unemployment, filing of labor and information, electronic, excuse me. And we have not heard this bill yet, so we will take this up, take public testimony on this, and then we'll go to Senate Bill 13, House Bill 23, Knick Arm Bridge, in which we are not going to move out of committee, but we did want to hear from the Kubota Board, who wanted to have some time to discuss the recent audit that was conducted concerning the Knick Arm Bridge. So we want to give them some time to do that. And then finally, we'll continue our discussion on Senate Bill 90, the school district employee health insurance. No, we don't. Senator Dunleavy, we're not moving that one out yet today either. So the last two, we will not be taking public testimony for those who are listening, Knick Arm or the employee health insurance. Okay, so with that, that'll be everything for today. So House Bill 76, unemployment, electronic filing of labor information. This is the governor's bill, and I believe Paula is – no. Oh, okay. I'm not sure who we got. Okay, we got is it Greg Cash and Paul Dick? Is that correct? Okay, great. So if you put your name on the record, introduce the bill to us, and the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Greg Cash, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner for the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. And with me is Paul Dick, the Director of the Employment Security Division. And also online, we have Aisha Pallison, Assistant Attorney General, the Department of Law. The bill before you, House Bill 76, broadly speaking, does four things. It allows for electronic filing of reports and documents. It improves our ability to recoup fraudulent UI, unemployment insurance payments. It adopts minor changes that bring us into compliance with the federal law governing the unemployment insurance program. Noncompliance with the federal law carries serious financial risk for Alaska employers, and changes how unemployment insurance tax rates are set in order to keep more money in the hands of Alaska's employers and employees, and thus keep more money circulating through our economy while protecting the integrity of the trust fund. Now, Paul Dick, the Director of the Employment Security Division, will provide a synopsis of the bill and a little more detail.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senators, members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 76 this afternoon. My name, for the record, is Paul Dick. I'm the Director of the Employment Security Division. A quick overview of the sections that in this bill is Section 1 allows for electronic filing in place of paper. Section 2 authorizes the legislature to appropriate general funds to the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. Section 3 and 7 are conformity, federal conformity provisions in this bill that puts us in conformity with federal requirements. And this is very important to the state because the biggest thing is that the employers right now enjoy a 90% Federal Unemployment Tax Act, or FUTA, tax credit. The tax credit is 6%, and employers get 90% credit because the state is in conformity. So essentially, employers pay 10% of that FUTA tax, or 0.6% rather than 6%. That, if we were to lose that credit and they were to pay the whole 6%, that would be an additional $378 for each employee each year, for employers that would have to pay that additional amount of money. Collectively, that equates to about $115 million coming out of our economy because of those taxes, that the additional taxes that would be paid to the federal government. Another thing that is a very good thing for Alaska is that it also requires that 30% of penalty collections be deposited into our unemployment insurance trust fund. What this means, currently 100% of the penalties go into the general fund. With this 30% provision in here, which again is a federal conformity matter, that means more money into our unemployment insurance trust fund from those penalties, which ultimately help employers because that money goes into our trust fund, helps build up our trust fund, which is a part of our, a component of our calculation of our unemployment insurance tax. So, 4 is a technical amendment, adding the word surcharges to be consistent with the subsequent section in the bill that mentions surcharges, which relates to one of those components of the unemployment insurance tax calculation. There's a base calculation that looks at our benefits over the prior 3 years, and then we have a provision in our statutes that have a target, if you will, of 3 to 3.3% for our trust fund. So we look at our trust fund balances and we look at benefits over the last 3 years, and those two components come together to make Alaska's unemployment insurance tax rate. Section 5 we're removing a table that is currently in our statutes to in its place put verbiage that takes the calculation of the solvency adjustments from 0.1% to 100%, hundredths of a percent. And so, in essence, that makes our trust fund solvency adjustment two things. Consistent with the base rate is calculated to the hundredths of a percent, but also makes for a more precise calculation on the solvency adjustment. It also removes a current limitation. Right now, tax rates from the surcharge or the trust fund solvency adjustment currently can rise or decrease limited to 0.3% each year. And so we have a section here in Section 5 that removes the 0.3 restriction limitation in years where our trust fund is solvent, and if we do our calculation, the normal decrease might be 0.5. Say right now we're limited to 0.3. Under this provision, we're removing that limitation, and so the trust fund solvency adjustment can decrease. There is no limit on the decrease. So in that example, the trust fund solvency could decrease by 0.5%. This is in times of decreases when the economy is in the normal business cycle of economic recovery and the economy is expanding, and it's an opportunity to put more money into the economy to help Alaska employers and Alaskans. Alaska is one of three states where the employer and employee pay into the unemployment insurance. They contribute into the fund. And part of those employee trust fund contributions go to our state training and employment program, or STEP, or the Alaska TVEP program, vocational education program. Those amounts will not be affected by this bill. Those amounts kind of come off right at the front part of the tax, and there's a flowchart in your packets that shows the flow of employee taxes come in. There's a certain amount of that goes into the STEP and TVEP funds, and so just to underscore that this bill doesn't affect the amount of training funds that will go to those two funds. Section 6 authorizes the Commissioner of Department of Labor and Workforce Development to suspend an unemployment tax increase. And I just want to underscore the word increase there. Under this bill, the commissioner could not suspend the base rate of the year prior. It's only in those years where an increase is at play. And there's some sideboards on this. One is that the average high cost multiple is 0.8 or greater, and after consultation with the department's actuarial staff. So those two things are in play there. It's not an automatic suspension. It does require the commissioner's action to make that action to suspend the increase only. What this does is it allows for flexibilities to adjust rates when the trust fund is healthy. Currently, we're coming out of a recessionary cycle, and our trust fund is building up. It's about $251 million today. A year ago, it was $202 million. So we're seeing where we're paying out less benefits and more revenue coming into the trust fund. And the trust fund is healthy, and so this allows for, a tweak, if you will. The formula stays the same. We're not changing the formula in the statute. We'll still go through that formula, calculate it, but it just gives the flexibility to make a tweak if we feel the trust fund is healthy, and allow more money into employers and employees' pocketbooks, and also more money into our economy when a time when it's really needed. So that's what's happening there with that proviso in the section there. Last year's tax rate increased from 3.04 to 3.32. It was a 0.28 increase. If this were in play, the base rate of 3.04% would still be there. So that just emphasizes that increase only. There's also in this bill under Section 10 a sunset to that trigger, if you will, of July 1, 2016. Section 8 authorizes the department to participate in a federal offset program that 19 other states are already participating in, and many other states are joining this year. And what this allows us to do is to offset federal tax income tax returns at the federal level against our unemployment insurance liabilities. We estimate that we would collect about $500,000 in additional collections. Repayments of benefits always go into the unemployment insurance trust fund, but what we would collect in penalties under the other sections I outlined in 3 and 7, 30% of those penalties would go into the trust fund. So we'd see some additional monies going into the trust fund from that. Again, this will more money into the trust fund mitigates tax burdens on employers. And it also, I think a very important thing about this is it gives us a tool to collect from persons residing out of state. We have folks that are perhaps collected benefits here in Alaska and moved south to other states, and they're out of our jurisdiction. So by participating in this federal offset program, we'll be able to collect against those folks from out of state. So it gives us a tool to collect from folks from out of state. The other sections pertain to effective dates, and Section 9 actually amends a section to define covered employment compensation debt in accordance with federal statutory definition. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The 30% requirement in deposits to the unemployment insurance, is that fixed, or can the state increase that percentage?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, the federal law actually says at least that amount, and we chose the 30% amount after consultation with our Assistant Attorney General, who is online if you want to, if you have any questions about that.
And do you know if other states are contemplating a higher percentage than the 30%?
Through the chair, I haven't studied that. I haven't asked. I'm not aware.
And why did for the benefits that you described, why did you suggest the minimum that's required by the federal government?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I might defer here to Asia Pallison, our Assistant Attorney General, I think could better articulate that.
There's a couple people online. Was Ms. Paulson one of them? Is that what you said?
Pallison.
Pallison. Okay, yeah. Ms. Pallison and a Mr. Steinberger. And you want Ms. Paulson to answer that question? Okay. Are you online? Ms. Paulson?
Pallison.
Pallison. Pallison. Okay. Ms. Pallison, are you online? Hello?
Hello, through the chair. This is Asia Pallison, Assistant Attorney General. My apologies. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we sure can. Thank you. Did you hear Senator Hoffman's question?
I did. And Senator Hoffman, through the chair, my understanding is that the 30% amount was chosen because that is what was necessary to comply with the federal requirement so that Alaska could maintain federal compliance. And that's what I advised the department to do, to be in federal compliance.
Well, I understand that, but the question really was, for the benefits that describe that change by federal law to have a minimum of 30%, what additional benefits would the state of Alaska receive if that percentage were higher?
Senator Hoffman, I don't know that the state would receive any additional federal monetary benefits if the state raised the rate that goes into the trust fund. And my apologies if I'm not understanding your question.
Well, I guess the trust, if the funds did not go into the general fund and went into the trust fund, then we would have more dollars that could be utilized for the other programs that were described by the two presenters, either in the STEP or the TVEP or other programs to help train and employ Alaskans.
Yes, and through the chair, again, the 30% of penalties collected is the minimum that must go into the trust fund. It cannot go into the general fund to maintain compliance with federal regulation.
I'm well aware of that, and that is why, you know, if we went north of that to a higher percentage, that we could assist Alaskans in getting more training, if that is a major benefit that we could realize instead of having all the 70% go into the general fund. So we'd be specifically benefiting the employment workforce from the people that are working in the state of Alaska. That is my question.
Through the chair, my apologies. I'm going to have to defer to someone from the Department of Labor to describe how the flow of funds would work. I don't know. My apologies.
My question is, if we went and increased it, could we increase some of the programs?
Through the chair, Paul Dick again. Senator Hoffman, I think perhaps, if I understand your question, could we increase that percentage from 30%?
No, you already answered that. You said that was the minimum. We could increase it. If we increased it,
right,
could we increase some of the benefits or the programs to train more Alaskans or further their education even further in those areas?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, those penalties, the training programs come from the employee contribution, and this is not employee contribution. These are penalties. So they would not, the additional funds, unless through the general fund you appropriated money for training.
Where would the 30% go then, Mr. Chairman?
Right. Yes, through the chair, Senator Hoffman. So currently, all of the money that we collect just on the penalties goes into the general fund. Now, under this bill, 30% of those collections would go into the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund, and then the 70% would go to the general fund.
And so another scenario would be that employer rates could be reduced if the 30% was increased.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, yes, an increase in the rate would increase revenues into the trust fund and mitigate those tax rates.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Other questions?
Wouldn't be fair if I asked any questions, Senator, Mr. President, Mr. Chairman. What's the most important? What section could you live without in this bill?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, we feel that all of the provisions of the bill are critical and very important. We have the conformity, which is important because it would mean more dollars coming out of more payment coming from the FUTA tax credit loss. We believe also that the Section 6, which perhaps garners a little bit more attention than some of the other sections, is really important to allow more money into the economy, more money for employers. So we feel the bill in its entirety is critical to Alaskans, to Alaskan businesses.
Thank you.
Is there a time where we have to do this? A time limited in order to be in conformance?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Our conformance is required by October 21st. This year, 2013.
Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I might, how long have we been out of compliance?
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, we have until October 21st to become compliant, so we're not out of compliance right now. The federal government actually required these 2 years ago, and they recognize that they have to go through a legislative process. And so typically when they do these sorts of things, they give states 2 years, kind of a 2 years advance notice that these are requirements that are required to allow for this process.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I just was trying to get clarity on when the federal government changed their procedures that then they asked us. So if the answer is 2 years ago, if that's correct.
Through the chair, it really was October 21st of 2011, so not quite 2 years ago from now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And again, what happens if we don't become compliant?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we lose the biggest, I think, impact to Alaskans, Alaska businesses, is we lose that Federal Unemployment Tax Act or FUTA tax credit that businesses, or tax, we lose the tax credit, which is 90% of the tax rate. And that is, equates to that $378 per employee each year.
Okay. Additional questions?
Public hearing?
Yep. Okay. Let's go to public hearing then.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Do we have any public hearing? Okay. We have no one signed up to testify on this. Was there anybody here in Juneau who wanted to testify? Kind of a quiet crowd today. Okay, then we'll go ahead and close public testimony. For now, we'll set this bill aside. Senator Fairclough, did you have a...
Mr. Chairman, would you like to review the fiscal notes quickly?
Or? Sure, yeah, we can go ahead and do the fiscal notes. Yep.
Mr. Chairman, there are two fiscal notes labeled 3 and 4. The first one from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Allocation is to the Commissioner's Office, OMB component number 340. It has a zero fiscal note from FY 2014 forward. The second fiscal note in the package today is fiscal note number 4. It's for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Allocation to unemployment insurance, OMB component number 2276. If I direct the member's attention down to change in revenue, we show an increase of $500,000 FY14 through FY19. I'm not sure, Mr. Chairman, if that's still accurate, if we've changed the sunset date to 2016, but that's the anticipated revenue increase. On page 2, there is some impact to state revenue generation anticipated. As a result of Section 7 and 8, the department anticipates a net reduction of revenue to the general fund of $42,000 annually and a net increase of revenue to the UI trust fund of approximately $542,000 annually.
Okay, thank you, Senator Fairclough. Okay, for now then, let's set this bill aside and... go on to the next one. So let's take a brief at ease. Okay, finance is back. Next item we're taking up is Senate Bill 13, House Bill 23, Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. Let's see, we do have the House bill as well as the Senate bill, but the House bill has quite a few changes or differences than our Senate bill. So rather than going over the changes in the two bills, I thought what we would do, I think a lot of it had to do with some discussion about a recent audit that was done by our Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, and I know they're here in the audience, but I wanted to give the folks from Kubota an opportunity to talk about that audit and some of the findings that were discussed in the audit. So I think Mike Foster, correct?
And, correct.
And Judy Doughty?
Doherty,
sorry. Both with the Kubota project and board of directors. You're on the board of directors and you're the project?
I'm on staff. I'm the deputy executive director.
Okay, got it. Okay, so I'm going to turn the floor over to you. Maybe you can, we have the LBNA chairman with us here on the Finance Committee, so let me start out with Senator Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to put on the record that I understand that we have differences of opinions about the audit that's before us, but I wanted to state for the record that the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee have full support of our auditors. They have worked within the realm that was asked for them, and so as we go through the audit, I have asked Chris Curtis, our auditor, to be in attendance, and if there are comments that are made that need to be responded to, then I've asked the chairman to allow her to come forward to make those responses. With all respect to all of the hard work that's been done by the Kubota board in trying to move a project forward that I support, that some community members have questioned the actual numbers on it. I know that's where we're going to talk, but I just wanted to lay out that I feel an obligation to protect the staff that is working on behalf of the legislature, and just wanted to put that up front, that in my role as chairman, I try to make sure that everyone gets their day in court, per se, or their an opportunity to say what they think about things. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Hey, thanks, Senator Fairclough. Before we get started, hopefully everybody has a copy of the LBNA's audit. I see Senator Olson has one there, and it looks like Hoffman. Yeah, okay. So everybody has a copy. All right, with that, I'll turn the floor over to you, Mr. Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the Senate, and good afternoon. My name, for the record, is Michael Foster. I'm the chairman of the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. Today I have with me to go over the audit is Judy Doherty, and she is our deputy executive director with the authority. I appreciate Senator Fairclough's comments, and we also have respect for the legislature and also the LBNA committee and the work they put into this audit. We welcome the opportunity to go through some of the findings and some of the concerns that we have, particularly over the model or the models that were used to predict population and social economics and demographic numbers. So at this point, I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Doherty. She has probably the best working knowledge of our staff. She was responsible for responding to most of the LBNA or auditors comments in the management report and the preliminary report. So at this point, I'll let Judy go ahead and address the committee. But again, thank you for the opportunity to present.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Judy Doherty. I'm the Deputy Executive Director for the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority and a licensed professional engineer in the state of Alaska. A little bit about my history. My career includes more than 20 years of service to the state of Alaska in transportation engineering. Prior to coming to Kubota, I served for 6 years as the Highway Design Chief for Central Region DOT. I've been at Kubota for the last 2 years. Let me tell you, I am grateful to finally have the opportunity to respond publicly to this audit. And so I would ask that you accept our thanks on behalf of the authority. First, I'd like to point out what DLA did not find in their audit. They found nothing wrong with the Kinnickerham Crossing project development process or governance. No problems with our contracting practices, nothing. Earlier this week, the legislative auditor testified in the House Rules Committee, I'm sure as everyone knows, that they couldn't audit our draft documents because they were a moving target, as she said, and in accordance with the standard auditing practices, they identified a scope change and they informed Kavada. That they did. But a balanced accounting of the general risk-reward calculus of an availability P3 contract could and should have been included in the report. While we have many other issues with this audit report, more minor issues, I would really like to address what everyone has seen in the headlines, and that's this issue of reasonableness. Reasonableness is what has blown this audit out of proportion and has damaged the progress of this important project. The auditors contend that the assumptions made for the Kinnickerham Crossing traffic model are not supported by independent sources. 6 different travel demand models have been completed since 2005 that predict traffic on the Kinnickerham Crossing.
Ms. Doherty, can you speak up a little bit or maybe put the mic a little closer?
Okay. All right.
Great, thank you.
Included in your packet is a three-page, it's got a graph on the front, of a population graph on the front.
Like this? Yep.
That's it, yes. On the second page of that packet, there's a list of these six studies that have been done that include the Kinnickerham Crossing project. These studies were performed not just for the Kinnickerham Crossing project, but also for DOT's highway-to-highway project and for the AMAT's Metropolitan Transportation Plan. All of these studies, each with their own set of underlying assumptions, variables, and limitations, indicate that 4 lanes will likely be necessary on the crossing no later than 2035. All of these have study boundaries that include the crossing location. All of these studies assume economic growth in the lower Matsu borough as a result of economic spillover from Anchorage once the crossing is constructed. 3 of these studies could have been used as a basis for comparison analysis by DLA or by a qualified consultant. The auditors have summarily dismissed these studies and have based their conclusion on a traffic model prepared for a DOT project located near Wasilla, more than 30 miles away from the crossing location, and whose study boundaries do not include the crossing location. A model that DOT is not using for their Kinnick Goose Bay Road project. It's a 4-lane project. A roadway that provides access to the lower Matsu borough and the Kinnickerham Crossing from Wasilla. The population and economic variables used in DLA's selected model are based on an assumption that there will be no change to the traditional population and economic growth in the lower Matsu borough as a result of the bridge opening. No change in job growth, no change in population growth. A model that predicts there will be 30% fewer jobs in Port McKenzie than ICER predicted would be generated by providing ferry service alone near the crossing site. Fewer jobs with a bridge than with a ferry that would deliver 20 vehicles per hour. That doesn't sound reasonable. The Kinnickerham Crossing project has had traffic studies performed by 2 separate consultants who arrive at very similar traffic volumes on the bridge, percent trucks, etc. Yet these corroborating evidence is dismissed by the audit as not being independent. And perhaps part of the problem is, auditing standards have a different definition of independent than professional standards amongst engineers. I don't know, and I'm sure that Chris could respond to that. The professional engineering firms who perform these studies are independent. They have no reason to collaborate and stake their professional integrity for the benefit of Kubota or for this project. The contractual relationship between Kubota and our consultants is no different than that of DLA and their hired consultant, who was engaged to help ascertain the reasonableness of the Kinnickahn Crossing traffic and toll revenue study. He was provided the model information on which DLA has based their conclusions, yet nowhere in his report does he conclude that the traffic and revenue projections for the crossing are unreasonable or overly optimistic. Those are DLA's terms. Terms that just don't appear to be appropriate in this instance. Their consultant uses much less onerous terms, like seems optimistic and maybe somewhat optimistic. His concerns were addressed in one-to-one correspondence with our traffic and revenue consultant, who provided insight to local conditions of the project site and variances in population projections. These correspondences are included in the audit report. DLA states in their two-page audit conclusion, this is a quote, since both the transportation model and the financial model are computer-based, performing what-if changes in underlying assumptions and data and evaluating their effect on outcomes should not be overly burdensome. We wholeheartedly agree with that statement. This is precisely what has already been done for this project in the form of over 2,000 Monte Carlo simulations of key traffic and toll revenue variables performed in 5-year increments and used as input to the financial risk analysis presented to you previously by David Livingstone of Citibank. Industry-leading financial minds have presented this value of this analysis to you, and the traffic volumes projected by DLA's what-if scenario are already accounted for in the range of risk analyses. It's unfortunate that the auditors did not recognize this when they evaluated the risk analysis and bring that tool and the value of that tool to you. As with every professional organization, we value and respect the professionalism and reputation of our staff and our hired consultants. It's something we assign great weight to when we engage them. Kubota's consultants represent the industry's who's who in transportation engineering, financing, traffic and toll revenue forecasting, and contract development legal support. Our consulting team has been involved in nearly every successfully delivered toll road financing P3 project in the country. Their credentials are included as an attachment in the audit report, starting on page 134. Kubota stands behind the work of our team. They're employed for their expertise in developing this project of statewide significance using the best industry practices and the highest standard of care. And I conclude my written comments at this point, and I welcome any questions you might have.
Questions from the committee? Okay. Senator Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to put into the record that I just became the legislative budget and audit chair this session, and so the work product that you see before you came to us in the course of over a year, I believe, conversation with a contractor, not exclusive of the LBNA committee. And so the previous chairman actually was the person, I believe, who requested the audit and worked out the exact framework that our auditors used in evaluating this particular proposal. So I'll just leave it at that.
Okay, very good. can you tell me when were you contacted by our auditor for information about the project?
Boy, I'm not sure when we were first contacted. I know our CFO, Kevin Hemingway, had informal conversations. They gathered quite a lot of information from us as they were beginning to prepare their work. We got management letter number one on February 1st. I had 10 days to respond. You know, the session was ongoing. We have a very small staff. We felt very rushed in responding to this audit report, and perhaps, you know, we used some strong language in that report. I'll be the first to admit it. But we were scrambling, and we just you know, I think that there has been a considerable lack of understanding of each other's standards.
Okay. Senator Fairclough?
It seems like some of the different perspectives on the traffic count is coming from an understanding of the P3. Would you say that's accurate or not?
I think that there is probably some concern over what would be considered toll friction. Toll friction can reduce the traffic count on a bridge because people have to be willing to pay. I can't speak for our traffic and toll revenue experts, but in an instance like this where, you know, you live in Eagle River, excuse me, I should have said through the chair, I'm new at this. You know, you can go through a constricted area like the military base, and then as soon as you reach some private land, a community pops up, and it can pop up quite quickly. And considering the drive around through Wasilla and into Anchorage, I think it's reasonable to expect that a community is going to pop up in the Mat-Su quite quickly. I know that the borough has already established a couple of town sites in the area in anticipation of this.
Senator Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, more where I was going is I was wondering if our auditors had access to the P3 because, as I understand it, it hasn't been finalized. So it's difficult for an auditor, I would guess, to actually audit something that's not complete. And so what kind of access or what kind of information might they have found if we had a completed P3, and I don't know the process of where that would come into play, when that would be completed as far as an audit and a review of that procedure would happen.
Let me answer that through the chair. For the record, Michael Foster, Senator Fairclough, is we did provide to the auditor the RFP or the draft RFP in the current state and the draft PPA. Both documents, the RFP and PPA, are still going through what I would consider the final reviews of the document, both through our consultants and then also through the governor's office, and the governor also has a legal consultant reviewing the document, and that information was provided. We did tell the auditors that it is confidential at this point because we're engaged in an ongoing procurement. But they certainly have the ability and opportunity to review and provide some risk analysis of what the RFP, or more particularly what the PPA, would have. And there was also a risk analysis that was done by Department of Law that actually had some of the evidence and stuff that would show the risk to the state if they engaged in the PPA. But the document is still in the working state. But we believe we're very close to the completion of that document, really pending legislation to include in the document.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My only recollection is reading the I know that I read it in the document, and I knew that it was draft. I believe it was confidential, so I'm not sure that the contractor would have been provided anything in the P3 if it was confidential to be able to consider as they move forward with the audit. And the auditors did come back to the committee again prior to my time there and amend the framework of how they would go forward with the audit.
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, we do have with us today Jeff Stark with the Department of Law, who actually is on Kubota's behalf overseeing the RFP and the PPA, and then also advised, I believe, your staff on using that document and how it could be used. So if you had legal questions, I would defer those to Jeff Stark with the Department of Law.
If I might add, through the chair, there are a number of benefits and risks that are associated with just a general structure of a P3 contract that we didn't see in the report. Things like schedule and cost certainty, you know, risks that are transferred to the developer that are fairly standard across the board with any P3 availability payment contract.
Senator Dunleavy, did you have a question?
I will. I'm just...
You're thinking? Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Either Mr. Foster or Ms. Doherty, you know, one of the questions that we have, certainly as we look at Alaska's history after the oil money started flowing into the area, we've got unfortunately a legacy of Alaska boondoggles that are out there with big ideas, and if you look at some of the things like the Point McKenzie Dairy Project, the Delta Agricultural Projects, the Healy King Coal Project, the Alaska Seafood Plant, the Seward Grain Terminal, and all those projects that are out there that essentially millions, if not billions, of dollars were spread out there, and you know, they've kind of all gone down the drain because of people with influence by the parties had a vested interest in these projects. And you know, there's a lack of an arm's-length economic viability test that went into these what I call big boondoggles, and those people that were considered visionaries were few and far between. And look at this thing here, and I'm not saying that this is a bad thing. I'm just saying that we're very skeptical, especially when we see that we're not going to be having the oil taxes coming in if Senate Bill 21 goes through, and we're trying to get the throughput up so we don't have funds available for the next several years like we have had in the last 5 years. I guess one of the big things that I see this us going down that same kind of track, that there's going to be another number with another thing, and that's going to say Kubota on it, because from what I'm seeing is that if you are off on the numbers, it's going to be another thing that the state of Alaska is going to be on the hook for. And so I guess that's where I'm coming from. And right now the concern I have is that how can I get rid of that concern that the people from my district that don't have any access to even roads are going to be footing the bill for this next 35 years for this multi-billion dollar construction project.
Mr. Foster.
Senator Olson through Vice Chair Fairclough. Maybe I can help relieve some of those fears. I don't know if I can or not. You know, I remember when the Parks Highway was built, you know, and the interior was growing, but it's not like it is today. And I grew up in Glen Allen, and certainly the folks on the Glen and the Richardson didn't want the parks because they saw it as distracting from their economic base in there. But when you look at infrastructure, you know, I hate to just make the remark that there isn't any real bad infrastructure when it comes to roads and transportation. What you look at is what the need is for that transportation, or where does it relieve other bottlenecks. Now you can look at models all you want. Let me just give you a few facts that's data. They're not speculation. The Point McKenzie area, the Fairview, Kinnick, Goose Bay area, which is looking to incorporate potentially, if they did incorporate for the boundaries they're looking at, they would be the fourth largest city in Alaska. That area right now, population-wise, is larger than Wasilla and Palmer combined. That area of the western side of the inlet is rapidly growing. You look at the traffic counts on the Kinnick Goose Bay Road in the last 10 years, or actually from 2000 to 2010, the traffic on Kennett Goose Bay Road, which is one of the roads that come out of Point McKenzie, went from 12,000 to 18,000, 45% growth in 10-year time frame. You look at the expansion that's happening in all the roads and infrastructures on the western side of the inlet and the growth that's happening. And you look at the bridge and you say, well, if it doesn't pencil out, Alaska's going to be on the hook. And one of the reasons that we have identified, and the governor asked us to identify the sideboards of that moral obligation, and we use what we consider to be a worst-case scenario, we put that in the bill. The CS has it, the $1.14 billion. But what you look at, if you don't build the bridge, what does that mean? And that's one thing the audit didn't look at, is the what no bridge scenario. DOT in 2008, in one of their traffic plans, regional traffic plans, looked at the same population growth. And, in fact, the population growth in that plan was less than the population growth that we saw in 2010 census. They estimated that there would be $3 billion plus in STIP money required for the Glen Highway improvements. Seems like a lot of money, but do you realize in this last GEO bond there's $35 million for a three-mile road out of Eagle River to help some of that congestion on the South Eagle River ramp? $35 million for 3 miles. When you look at the traffic counts coming into the Glen Highway, Kennett Goose Bay right now is 62% of the traffic at the Eklutna four-lane, where the Glen goes from two lanes to four lanes. Kennett Goose Bay right now is 62% of that traffic, and it's growing. That traffic at Eklutna has doubled over the last 25 years. Our projections is that it will double again. It is currently at about 36,000. We expect to see it in the 60,000 range by the year 2025. The Glen Highway at Highland right now, this sixth lane, is at 52,000. It's almost doubled in the last 25 years also. I live in Eagle River, and that area, that's where the growth is happening. 74% growth predicted in the next 25 years because that's where the available land is. The cost to put the Glen from 52,000 vehicles in the year 2010, a measured number, to a projected 110,000 vehicles based on the population growth, and it seems like an extreme number. But if you go back 25 years in history, the Glen is double from just 25 years ago. I mean, the growth is happening as growth to the north. And so that area, to go to an 8-lane or 10-lane, that's where the $3 billion comes in. So when you look at this help to relieve some of the concerns, I think you have to look at do nothing. The worst thing that can happen, the most costly thing that can happen, is to do nothing.
Senator Olson,
with all due respect, to do nothing, that would be to make it so that we don't start getting money into a money hole over there on the Kabata crossing, the CAC there, that we could be putting into other things like education right now. And that's where I see the issues. And in fact, as you talked about the numbers, and it's my understanding that the Matsu Borough Plan that's down there has a population in that area that you've talked about over on the McKenzie side as only one-third the number that you have there on your side of roughly 15,000 people. They've got only 4,400 there. And so when I see disparities like that, it almost goes back to that same issue that the parties that have vested interest in the project are not at an arm's length. And so because of that, I've called that into question. And right now, I'm not getting a whole lot of warm fuzzies about what the numbers are, because people that are independent of the audit, independent of the legislature, are coming up with numbers that are one-third of what you have. In fact, on your testimony, back on 4-2, I've got the notes here, that the Highland area in 1985 was 33,000. In 2010, like you pointed out, 20 years later, it's 53,000. You just told me that it was almost double. It's actually only 1.6. It's less than that. It's only 67% more. I just did the calculation on it. And as you looked at your numbers for 2035 show that you're at 110,000, which is more than double what it is today. And so because of that, I don't think that we're wrong to have questions about what's going on here. And I would say we've got serious problems. As you look at the CDM Smith, the people that were contracted by Kabata to go ahead and come out with some of these numbers here, they've got a reputation of being far and above and overly optimistic in some of their estimates. Is that not true?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I don't believe it is true.
You don't believe it is true?
No.
Well, let me see. There was a paper put out here that showed that at times they have been overly optimistic in one of your presentations on the 2nd of April. Is that not true?
I'd have to look at the presentation through the chair.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you. It's kind of more from the audit into Kibata, but since it has, the Healy coal plant, the Delta grain silos, et cetera, I don't think they ever, I don't think it's ever been fired up. I don't think it ever saw any grain in it. This is one of the few projects I can guarantee with absolutely 100% certainty. The minute it's done and the ribbon is cut, it'll be used. And the use will be continual and growing. I, too, live in rural Alaska for 20 years. I moved to the valley. And as a school board member, we were putting out a new school every single year in the valley. 400 kids per year, past 10 years. I'm not questioning the audit, because when I read the audit, on page one, it says the risks and rewards in totality as outlined in the P3 agreement could not be evaluated. I'll say that again. The risk and the rewards in totality as outlined in the P3 agreement could not be evaluated because the agreement has not been finalized. So, again, I don't fault the auditors for using the methodology that they did at this point. The point I'm trying to make is we're trying to make a prediction on traffic. I can guarantee you the traffic's going to be there. The question is, this is a new concept in terms of private-public partnership, and again, I've had the luxury of living at least the first 20-some years of my life in an area where there is freeways, they call them, which the park or the glen is a freeway, and right next to it, literally within just a couple miles, you have turnpikes, which are four-fee transportation corridors. And when they built, for example, it was called Route 9, but it's called the Pennsylvania Turnpike, now the Northeast Extension, you had people immediately using it. And if you go there now, if anyone's ever gone to that particular part of that particular turnpike or go to Jersey and have to go over bridges, there are lines of people paying tolls. I guess the point I'm trying to make is to compare this with certain, and I agree with the senator, certain boondoggles. We've had boondoggles. I don't necessarily believe this is one of them. And, you know, we can go down the list of ferries and what we're supporting there and how much we're supporting and that. The point being, is the area growing? Will Anchorage use it? And if there is no bridge, I guess the question is, what do we do? Are we going to add more lanes to the Glen Highway? And if we are, what is that going to cost? You have more than half the state's population within 30 or 40 miles of this issue we're discussing right now. So, again, I think... you know, I think we can go over the audit, and I think the questions will be very good questions. The question of whether there's going to be traffic on that bridge, I don't think there's any question at all.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. Senator Hoffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Getting to the audit, on page 19 at the bottom, it states, and I quote, in August 2012, Kibata Management submitted a TIFA loan request for $500 million at 49%. You know, dated September 25th, the Federal Highway Administration pending review request stated, Kibata's loan request did not present a compelling justification for providing the assistance at a 33% level. And that brings me to page 27, which are the findings. And I guess there are deficiencies, and for us to, as legislators, to ignore the findings, you know, or you trying to rebut them, it seems to me the solution is to address them. And I'm wondering if Kibata goes forward, are they going to address them, and what is the time frame, and what is the cost? In addressing the recommendations, there's basically one recommendation, and there are four bullet points, and I won't get into the specifics of the bullet points, but on the second page it says that the Federal Highway Administration guidelines for P3 state inaccurate or overly optimistic traffic projections and underestimated project costs can lead to the development of pro forma financials that appear to justify an investment decision, but the word but again, that do not reflect the project's actual ability to repay the debt or meet the equity investors' return requirements. So as a legislator, I cannot ignore the recommendations. You are rebutting them, but are the Kubota board, is the Kubota board going to address the recommendations in the deficiencies as pointed out by the audit, addressing the five bullet points, and if so, what is the time frame? Because I have nothing else to go on but to follow the recommendations of the audit.
Ms. Doherty.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman. These bullet points are addressed in our response to the preliminary audit report. I can guide you through the document if you'd like.
Well, it would seem then if you, well, I guess I'll go over those, and instead of taking the committee's time, I would like to go over them as well in more detail. I have been on the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee in the past, but I am not a member now, and for me, this is the first time that I'm reviewing this audit.
Ms. Doherty?
Coming through the chair. You'll notice, Senator Hoffman, that three of these bullets specifically reference the Point McKenzie area, you know, economic growth and development in the Point McKenzie area. And I think that my previous discussion regarding the model that was compared to the model we used didn't really address the influx of traffic and employment and economic growth that will come from Anchorage. Trips that are currently being taken within the Anchorage bowl will suddenly expand to include trips across the bridge to the Port McKenzie area. I think that's a very significant difference in the two models that were compared. And it just really doesn't pass the red face test to think that Anchorage is not going to generate trips across that bridge.
Thank you, Ms. Doherty. Mr. Foster?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, it was our response to the preliminary reports actually found in the back of the audit, and it starts on page 211, it's Appendix I. And our response to some of those recommendations are in there. We certainly are able to expand on that, provide additional information to LBNA or to this committee if there's additional information that's requested. But we did take the preliminary report. We did respond to that, and it is included at the back of the LBNA audit.
Thank you, Mr. Foster. Are there any other questions from committee members? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. Senator Bishop wants to go.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I also have some of the same findings as Senator Hoffman, and you know, this boils down to, we got to get down to whose numbers that we can all agree on to go forward on the cost scheduling on the project. I want to build a bridge as bad as anybody, because that's what I made a living doing, is building highways and bridges. And I think that sentiment is shared by most of us. We got to find what those numbers are that we can all agree on and move forward. So that's my two cents worth at this point.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Senator Olson, did you have a question?
Actually, well, I do have a question. One of the things I just can't seem to find the April 2nd document I was pointing out by Wilbur Smith, or I guess it was now CDM Smith, but one of the things that is there is that that area has got a history of projects that have been very expensive and have one not even being utilized, which is the Mat-Su jail that's over there. It was several hundred million dollars over budget, and there was some very grave concerns about that. And then now we got this ferry that's out there that can't be used. And the lack of foresight by the people that are in charge, and I realize that they may not even be around anymore, are there. But one of the things that the audit brought out was that if for some reason the P3 management situation turns out and have lower than expected toll revenues, that the state of Alaska will be making payments, and they'll still have to be made to the private partners, regardless of how much the British use. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, that is correct. The state's responsible for making the availability payments, and regardless, the developer, the private partner, regardless of the toll revenue or the traffic revenue, the state is still responsible to make those payments to the private developer.
That's where the issues that I have and I represent, don't see any reason why we should be in this situation if we're depending on numbers that are suspect to start off with, and then we're on the hook for the next 35 years for the billions of dollars that are owed. Do you fault people for being suspicious of your project?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, absolutely not. The residents of Alaska should evaluate every project, whether it's the clean coal or whether it's the seafood processing center or the dairy system or a road expansion. In this case, one of the things I think earlier that was kind of said or led to is that, we have potentially some motive to why we're trying to push this project forward. And, we are a public corporation of the state. We do not have an agenda. If the legislature or the state decides this is not a project that should be going forward, then that's the decision that the state makes. Our job is to, as accurately as possible, provide that information to the legislature, and that's one of the reasons we welcome this opportunity to present. If you go to page 37 in your audit, that's a table that does a comparison of basically the consultant from Arizona that did the review for LB&A audit, and then our population, traffic, financial model. The biggest difference, you can look at it, the left side is more of a local type model, the right side is more of a regional model. The local model doesn't show an influx of folks from Anchorage coming to Point McKenzie for commercial or industrial jobs. The model on the left is really just a transportation or what I call a traffic model versus a social economic model. The model that was used on the left was a model that, as Judy had mentioned, really didn't consider the impacts of the Kinnickerm crossing. In fact, when we talked to Mat-Su Borough, they said, until we know for certainty or until we know in time when that bridge would be there, we really have to move ahead as if the bridge isn't there. And I think as Senator Dunleavy said, is from the day it opens, you're going to start to see traffic, you're going to start to see use. That is what the right side of the column says. The right side is a regional model. You look on the left side, it even says Connect Goose Bay Corridor. It doesn't have any residential growth. And we know that's where some of the largest growth is in the Mat-Su Borough area. The difference between, the model that the consultant used for LB&A and our model is primarily local versus regional, bridge versus no bridge. And so we expect that you'll see a lot of use of the bridge from people going east to west just as much as you see people from the west side coming to the east. That model, this page, pretty well sums up the comparison of the two models that were looked at.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I guess one of them, I'm glad you brought up the idea that Senator Dunleavy talked about some of the toll roads that are out there in the PA area, having lived out in that area. The difference that we have between them and there is that, you know, there are millions and millions of people to go ahead and pay tolls out there to try and justify some of the costs of these, and they're expensive. Tollways are expensive. Roads are expensive. Up here, we don't have the population to go ahead and share that. Right in the Anchorage Bowl area, you got 300,000 to 400,000 people. Of that, only a minority of people are going to be doing that. But as you look at that situation, I guess the only other question that I have at this point is that it's been my understanding that Cabot has been turned down for low interest federal loans, which have been asked somewhere between $300 to $500 million, half a dozen times. And I think at your April 2nd presentation, you said it was actually four times. Is that true?
Mr. Foster.
Through the chair, Senator Olson. It is four times. We have submitted letters of interest, knowing that there was a very small pot of TIFIA money available. The project wasn't as mature as it is now, which means the permits and the right-of-way in place, the P3 RFP close to being finalized, waiting based on legislation. The earlier ones, actually somebody yesterday in the House side referred to it as a FERC application, where you submit a couple of them and you keep getting closer. You keep the project in front of the federal entity that has the funding. You know, earlier on, although we submitted those letters of interest, you know, this there was a small pot. Now the pot is much larger, $17 billion in capacity, which is about $52 billion in actual construction costs. You mentioned earlier that we have a number where it's 49%, and TIFIA has two levels that you can apply for. Our model, our financial model, and our moral obligation sideboards is actually based on a 33%. You know, if we were fortunate enough to be invited to the 49%, that would be outstanding. We're anticipating that we would be in the 33% pool.
Thank you, Mr. Foster.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you. Just a comment. I think it's approximately 360,000 people with one road, major road. And back east where I came from, there certainly were millions of people, and there had to be countless thousands and thousands and thousands of roads. But again, there's very few guarantees in life, and I'm not a gambler, and I don't bet. This would be one that I would say the second the concrete is dry and the ribbon is cut, you better get out of the way, because there's going to be folks on that road, and that that usage will do nothing but grow. And I'll just make a comment. It's you know. We're interjecting a concept of where a large project is going to have to pay for itself, and I think it's a new concept. I think it's a worthwhile concept to take a look at, and I think as we go down this road, we may be looking at more and more of that any project. We just voted on a gas bill this morning. We're talking about other mega projects. I think it may be something to look at, that any additional projects we look at for the state that serve the needs of the state and folks of the state, we may want to make sure that they pay for themselves, all of them. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. The previous speaker spoke about the large projects have to go ahead and pay for themselves. Is that correct, Mr. Foster?
Mr. Foster.
Through the chair, Senator Olson. Are you asking my opinion if the large projects should have to pay for themselves, or
no? I just want to make sure you heard the comment.
Yes, I heard the comment.
Okay, and we just confirmed that if there are lower than expected toll revenues, the state is going to have to step up to the plate to go ahead and have the availability payments to be made to the private partners, regardless of how much the bridge is toll, so that even if the project doesn't pay for itself, the state is still on the hooks for billions of dollars. Is that correct,
Mr. Foster?
Senator Olson, through the chair, no, that is not correct. We do have a sideboard on it. It is not billions of dollars. There is a $1.14 billion. That $1.14 billion is not the availability payments. A majority of that $1.14 billion is a termination for convenience or a default event where the state chooses either to buy the contract out or the state, for whatever reason, defaults, which is highly unlikely. Our model, a 35-year model, and we base it on a worst-case scenario, which is we say that there's a 95% probability that the traffic will be at this low level, which is only a 5%. It won't make it to even this level. Worst-case scenario, even after 35 years, the bridge has still paid for itself. It has still paid back any appropriations to the reserve account back to the state, to the general fund. So our model shows, even in a worst case, that the bridge pays for itself. On a best case, or on our base case scenario, which is a 50% probability of making that traffic over the 35 years, we show about a $980 million surplus to the state that would have to be used for Title 23 statewide infrastructure. It cannot go back to the GF fund, and Kubota is a public corporation. That money would go back to maybe a future transportation fund or something.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. I have a couple questions. The first one I want to just make sure, so those listening at home, we made reference earlier to page 19, and we said under a bullet point talking about the TIFIA loan program, and it was stated, which is absolutely accurate, that the report says Kubota's loan request did not present a compelling justification for providing assistance above the 33% participation level. If you flip the page to page 20, it goes on to say the request cannot be considered further until the $150 million reserve fund is appropriated by the state and it becomes clear that funding is reasonably likely to be appropriated. So that there are checks and balances that our auditors tried to provide as guidance if this project should go forward in front of the legislature. So I'd point that out first. But where we're at today is we have a finding that's created a lot of conversation, which is good for any project. A project this size should have a lot of conversation. So what I'd like to know is, what's the consequence of the legislature not acting in this legislative session? As the president of the Senate said earlier today, this is day 88. We have 89 and 90, and we are all trying to comply with what the voters of Alaska have asked us to do, and that's complete our business in 90 days. So if you could briefly provide the committee, what is the consequence of not acting? Mr. Foster.
Madam Chair, we were here, same room, last year. The consequences then are pretty much the consequences today. We're still moving forward with the RFP process, the PPA agreement. We still have some permits that we're finalizing that we expect to have soon. If we did not get this legislation this year, it possibly, more than likely than not, would put us a little further down the list in TIFIA. Now, although I believe there's 17 states, 28 or 27 projects in the queue right now, is still below, the total number of those projects is still below the capacity of TIFIA. We are still far ahead of many of those projects as far as shovel ready. If the legislation did not pass this session, I think we're still viable for TIFIA a year from now, but that's all dependent on how much of the TIFIA money is allocated between now and then. If legislation is passed this session, it just means that we're that much closer to, and again, there is no guarantee. If you ask Federal Highways, there's no guarantee that this legislation will put us in the TIFIA pot. It just gets us to that point that, as you saw a letter in the quote on page 20, actually comes out of a quote that came from Federal Highways to Kubota and to the governor. It talks about the legislation and the reserve fund and the appropriation and the commitment of the state. The federal government wants to see, before they move forward with a project like this or invite us to submit an application, and that's the key words, because any entity, any public entity can submit a letter of interest. It's that invite to submit the application that triggers, you know, basically that you're in line now for funding. And so there's several things that we need to do. If legislation is passed this session, it helps us. If legislation isn't passed this session, we will continue forward with the permitting, the finalizing the PPA, the RFP, continue our involvement with major projects with federal highways, continue our involvement with the administration. And so, you know, every year a delay means another year. Interest rates can fluctuate, they can go up. The availability of TIFIA money can dwindle. As you know, all kinds of factors can change. There was a comment made in rules about urgency. You know, I don't look at any major project, and I think Representative Hawker made this comment about mega projects. Mega projects should not be decided on based on schedules. They should be decided based on good economic financial decisions. And so as we move this project forward, you know, I believe that the project is well vetted. I think we are very close. We still have our work to do. As you know, the House passed some legislation last night, which is very different than Senator Huggins' legislation. My opinion is that legislation could set us back because there is not a financial model through the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Whether they can use our model or not is still a question. I rely on the good people of this legislature and the good people of the state to make these decisions for us. As I said earlier, we're part of a corporation. Whatever the state of Alaska or the good people in the legislature decide is the direction that this project will go.
Thank you, Mr. Foster. In wrap-up, Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you. Just a quick question. To your knowledge, do you know if there is discussions or plans in the books to upgrade the Glen Highway out of Anchorage?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, yes, there is. And, in fact, there's one upgrade going on right now through the GO bond. There's a $35 million expansion, or a one-lane expansion for three miles.
And are the folks that are going to drive that road, are they going to be paying a toll to help fit the bill for that road?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, they cannot be required to pay a toll because the road was built under federal highway money. There's only one option, therefore you can't toll it. Now, there has been suggestion that you could toll the Glen, but you would have to add a hot lane or a dedicated lane. A commuter has to have an option if you have a road that's constructed under federal money.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. I've heard that quoted twice, so since that's in my area, I just wanted you to know that that's only partial funding. So when you're quoting $35 million for that bridge expansion, I think it's between 70 and 90 that we've heard, and that needs to be done on both sides. So we've only done one section of that. So just the bridges alone for expansion are significantly more than you've stated on the record, but DOT could give us a better estimate on that. Senator Dunleavy, we might could talk because I think that analysis may be important to the legislature. If the legislature does not concur, the Senate doesn't concur with what the House has done or don't move a project forward, it may be in our best interest to understand the costs to upgrade the Glen Highway so we do make a decision based on facts because that is important to all of us. With that, I would like to thank you for coming forward. I know that you've invested a lot of time from the private sector. I know that you are a private business owner, an engineer, and you've invested countless hours, Mr. Foster, on behalf of moving this project forward, as well as the staff. And I appreciate our legislative staff doing their work on behalf of the legislature, too. So with that, I will take a brief at ease while we move on to Senate Bill 90. Brief at ease.
All right, we're back. Okay, at this time, we'll go now to discussion on Senate Bill 90. Let's see. We had discussion on this yesterday. This has to do with the school district employee health insurance. We had not discussed the fiscal notes, so we wanted to go over the fiscal notes. We're not taking public testimony today. So I think that was the last thing we wanted to do for now, was to kind of go over the finances of it. So Senator Dunleavy, yes.
Thank you, Senator Meyer. Yes, we're going to have folks from the Department of Administration come up and talk about the fiscal notes. I do want to thank the committee for hearing the bills. And, you know, it's my suggestion that we hold it over the summer because I think we're going to get a lot more folks understanding the bill and a lot more folks that are going to end up supporting the concept. So thank you.
Thank you. Well, I do appreciate you bringing this to our attention. There does seem to be potential savings here, but we really don't know if this what the impact is to the teachers, the employees, and I think in fairness to everyone, we want to have that thorough understanding and do the quantitative analysis. But yeah, the fiscal note itself is kind of frightening. So it would be good if Mr. Barnhill, if you could explain the fiscal notes to us.
Sure, Mr. Chair. Mike Barnhill, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Administration. There are three Department of Administration fiscal notes, and I'm going to start first one with the Health Plans Administration note that's dated 4/5/13 that has the $100 million on it. And I think my hope is, Mr. Chair, that once we get done with the explanation, that it won't be so frightening. To understand the fiscal notes, we need to understand the mechanics of the bill, and so I'll start with that. The bill proposes to consolidate all school district employees into the State of Alaska Active Employee Health Plan. By our actuary's estimate, that is approximately 18,300 school district employees and 47,000 total, so 29,000 dependents, 47,300 total covered lives. In order to accommodate that transition, bringing 47,000 new people into our existing pool, which has about 16,000 people, we need cash, Mr. Chair, in order to pay claims, because the day those folks arrive, they're going to incur health care claims immediately, and so we need transitional cash flow in order to accommodate that. In order to estimate how much transitional cash we need, it's helpful to know how much is this current population, this population of 47,000 people, expending right now. And I started on this the other day. There is a sheet in your packet which has the summary of healthcare costs for this population for FY12. It says there's $282 million expended. And so what we've done is simply round that up to $300 million. We think this pool will expend around, it'll probably be more than that, quite frankly, Mr. Chair, around $300 million in FY15 when this bill would take effect. And in order to have enough cash, we would like to have 4 months' worth of claim costs in our reserve account when they arrive, or at least access to be able to get that. 4 months' worth of claims costs, if you're spending $300 million, you just divide by three, that's $100 million. So that's where the $100 million comes from, Mr. Chair. And then the other part of this bill is it allows us to get that $100 million transitional cash flow through draws from the Public Education Fund. We don't have to draw it all at once. We could draw it over a 10-year period. I have no way of telling the committee today how fast we would draw that. So for purposes of this fiscal note, we've shown the draw all in the first year. So in FY14, we've shown it so that we would potentially draw it all in the first year, have that that cash flow available immediately. But in likelihood, Mr. Chair, we would draw it probably over time. The other part of the bill with respect to the $100 million cash flow is there's a payback. And the way the payback works is we bill the school districts for their first 4 months' worth of claims. The school districts each have 10 years to pay those claims back. The way we've shown that in the fiscal note is $10 million payments over the course of the fiscal note. So $10 million receipt authority to collect it, move it back into the public education fund. As a side note, Mr. Chair, we were on the phone with an administrator from the Texas Teachers Retirement System today. They did a consolidation very similar to this several years ago. They got access to $25 million worth of cash for transitional cash flow purposes, and they paid it back. So this mechanism for transitional cash flow that gets repaid has precedent in the state of Texas. And if there's any interest, they consolidated somewhere around 400,000 people, bigger scale.
So, Mr. Barnhill, why are we using the public education fund?
Mr. Chair, first let me preface my response by saying the Department of Administration is entirely indifferent to where these funds come from. All we're saying is we need money in order to pay these claims. We don't care if it comes from the general fund, from the SBR. The reason why the Public Education Fund was chosen as a fund source is because it's monies that is related to public education. These are school district employees for whom the health care costs would be paid from with this source of funding.
Okay. I think we'd want to use a different fund for reasons, but we don't need to elaborate on that now.
And that's completely fine, and we have no objection to the legislature identifying some other fund source.
Okay. Senator Faircliffe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How about some schools have an opportunity and have a tax base that they can help pay those funds back, but other schools, specifically in rural Alaska or smaller schools, don't have much other tax base that they would have money that was coming from outside of the state. And so I'm wondering how that rolls through in the form of some future payment from the state of Alaska, why we're transferring buckets like that if individual communities don't have the ability to pay that fund really back directly. It seems like it's going in and out, and is there a reason that it's going in and out?
Through the chair, Senator Faircloth, it's a completely fair point. Some school districts, their entire school budget is paid through the BSA. Some school districts have a 30% participation, 35% participation. For those school districts that are 100% funded by the BSA, the funds would come from those funds in order to make this payback. To your point about circulating funds, well, yeah, that's exactly what's happening. The intent of constructing it this way is to hold the public education fund harmless over time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Barnhill, I guess one of the comments that you've made kind of caught my attention was that the Texas situation where the payback was with 400,000 people, how long did it take them to pay how much back?
My understanding is it didn't take that long because they were able to structure the transition in a way they didn't actually have to draw on the cash flow. And we can get that into that in a second with the other fiscal note. But we have another cash flow established in this bill, and that is the benefit credit stream that comes from the school district. In the case of Texas, they had the premiums coming in from the school districts, and that cash flow was sufficient to manage the transition.
Mr. Chairman, if I continue, as we look at that model, with the population a tenth of what's there that would be involved, or maybe closer to a 20th, I guess, can that model work up here as well?
Through the chair, Senator Olson. Boy, you know what? It just would be imprudent for me to suggest in any way that we do not need the transitional cash flow that we've requested here. And I mean, one thing that's different about Texas is their overall health care costs are significantly lower than our overall health care costs are in the state of Alaska. And the other thing that's really important to bear in mind is we know how many people this bill requires to come into our plan. We know really nothing about the condition prevalence within that population, how many, you know, cardiac cases there are, how many depression cases there are, brain cancer, premature babies. And so for me to sit up here and say, oh, yeah, we could probably get by with the premium cash flow that's going to come, we're not willing to do that.
Well,
follow-ups?
Just a comment. I commend the wisdom of the bill sponsor to go ahead and hold it over and look at this, because we were getting a fair amount of input from teachers throughout the state, both in the district and outside the district, and in spite of the lighter discussion over the last big project, I think that he's got the element of wisdom has prevailed.
Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you. It's good that we're going to take time with this. I'm also getting lots of phone calls and emails from, interestingly enough, other groups that may be interested in becoming part of this larger pool. So that can be kind of a problem or a blessing. It's going to be a very interesting ride through this concept, because there's been other groups and other municipalities that have heard that what we're doing, and they're starting to become very interested. So it's certainly garnering some discussion.
And Madam Chair, I'd be happy to comment on that. I mean, we've all had our attention drawn to this concept, and we've been trying to research what's been going on elsewhere. And over the past couple of days, I've been looking at the state of North Carolina, which has consolidated all of its teachers, all of its state employees, its university employees, state hospital, community colleges into one pool, 668,000 people, employees and dependents in one pool. And it's just very interesting to see that this pooling has been done at scale that dramatically outstrips what we're proposing to do here. The other very interesting thing about North Carolina is the state benefit credit for that pool is $436 a month. Ours this year is $1,330 a month. And sharing that with the committee, in no way am I suggesting that this bill would ever produce a reduction in the state benefit credit. It just won't. But it does appear that pooling in other places has been done, and the state benefit credit is significantly lower. Is there a causal link between the two? I will not say that.
Thank you, Mr. Barnhill. Other questions from committee members? I have one. Well, I have several. But the first one that comes to mind is, how will other trusts be affected by a state change in pooling? So specifically, we heard from NEA, who has a trust, Ms. Kidder, I believe, yesterday. I'm not sure if I have that name exactly right, but they have a trust. It has payments in it and recipients that receive benefits from it. So how will those trusts, or do we know the implication for those trusts as we try to reach pooling to try to benefit all Alaska?
Yeah. Madam Chair, what this bill would do is eventually close those trusts. There would need to be a transitional time period because health insurance claims can get incurred in one fiscal year or one plan year and not resolved until the following plan year, in some rare cases, maybe the year subsequent to that. And so those trusts would need to maintain sufficient funds in order to pay those incurred claims until they're finally resolved. But ultimately, this bill calls for transferring all of the employees and dependents that are currently being served by those trusts into the state of Alaska's active pool.
Just to follow up on that, there's assets that are currently in those trusts that are drawing interest to benefit those the participants of the plan. Are we proposing some type of a way to close those down, or what will happen to that? I'll just put it on the table that when I was serving on the Anchorage Assembly, there was a negotiated, I believe, a move of funds from an overfunded pension fund. And so there was I won't say litigation, but there were agreements between attorneys and entities to close that particular pension or distribute assets out of that pension. So how would that work from a health perspective as we move to who has claim to those assets? Does it stay in the trust? Does it move with the participants of the trust, or how will that be determined?
Yeah, Madam Chair, that's a really interesting question, and as we were thinking through how the finances of this bill would be constructed, we thought about that. And this bill does not address private trust funds and what would happen to them once the beneficiaries of those trust funds move into the state's plan. I suspect that what would happen is that the trust assets would be drawn down in their entirety prior to transition. But I don't know that for a fact. The bill, however, does address the trust assets of those school districts that self-insure. And then any unencumbered balance, the word unencumbered isn't currently in the bill, but it should be at some point. Any unencumbered balance at the point of transition, the bill calls for providing that, transferring that balance to the fund that we use to fund claims. That's the Group Health Life Benefits Fund in AS 3930095. Again, in the school district self-funded context, our anticipation is that school districts would draw down that balance of the trust fund until it's close to zero. It's in their best financial interest to do that. So we did not want to rely on the existence of trust fund monies being transitioned to us at that point in transition in order to pay health claims on the incoming folks. I just felt that was too risky a gambit, and that's why we requested there be a different source of cash flow, transitional cash flow, to pay that, and that's where the public education fund came from.
Senator Olson.
You talked about the private trusts that are out there. I thought that the NEA trust was a private trust. Did it come to the wrong conclusion?
No, Matt, through the chair, Senator Olson, it is a private trust. But there are, like, the Anchorage School District, for instance, it self-funds its own trust. So in the Anchorage School District, they have a number of health plans. One is self-funded by the Anchorage School District. Other plans are funded and managed by union trust plans, NEA and Local 51.
Senator Dunleavy, did you have a...
No, I was just
going to
be closing
with this. Senator Dunleavy, I just would ask for your consideration and at least a conversation over the summer with the trust to see what their perspectives are on the assets that they hold. Certainly, where there's a contract negotiated that the state has been paying 100% of all those costs, I think the state has at least a right to assert some ownership of some of those assets, but the interest and the interest that was managed in a private entity, I'm not sure where the state would have, where our rights would start and stop there. So interesting questions, very complicated. Mr. Chairman, Senator Dunleavy is prepared to make some closing comments on SB 90 as we retire it for the summer.
Very good. I'm sorry, Mr.
And I hate to say this, Mr. Chair. There's actually two more fiscal notes, and I can go through them.
Oh, yeah. There's
super quickly. I know you want to get out of here. So the other one is the Health Plans Administration, with the indulgence of the chair, that starts with the $237.7 in FY14. Those are startup costs. We need to reprogram our computers to accommodate essentially a quadrupling of the pool. Good news is that every single one of these inbound members has a retiree identification number, because each of these folks is already an active member of either PERS or TERS. We just have to scale up the system. And then running across the services line, those are the contractual costs that we pay to our third-party administrator and other vendors. That's a per-member, per-month charge. That grows by the rate of personal services growth, which is 4%. That comes from our actuary. The bigger line is the $315 million. That's two parts. $305 million of that, those are the bills that we send to the school districts for the benefit credit. Right now, we're projecting for FY14 and for FY15 a benefit credit. That's the economy level premium and the preventive dental premium that we have for our state of Alaska employees. That's $1,389 for FY14 and FY15. You multiply that by 12 months, multiplied by the population of this 18,300, the school district population, that's about $305 million. So this gives us receipt authority to send those bills out, collect them, deposit them into the Group Health Life Benefits Trust Fund. The remaining $10 million of that $315 million, again, is the receipt authority to collect the $10 million from the school districts to repay the public education fund over time. The final note is our personal services note. That's the retirement and benefits note with 482 in FY14. We need 12 staff, an addition of 12 staff to manage quadrupling this pool. We would start hiring those folks in January. I understand the bill's not going to move, so we would push that forward a year. And then it would be 964 going across. Those staff are call center staff, operations techs and staff, appeal staff. And that, Mr. Chair, is it.
Okay, well, thank you for that presentation. Big issue. And I understand the pooling and you know, the more people you have participating, the less the costs. But how many other estate bargaining units have their own trust? It's not just the teachers.
Mr. Chair, in the state we have the ASEA Health Trust, which is comprised of 8,800 general governmental unit employees of the state of Alaska. That's the largest chunk of health trust for the state of Alaska. We also have PSEA has opted out of our health insurance. They don't have a health trust. They are fully insured, I believe, by Aetna. Master Mates and Pilots has a health trust, and Labor Trades and Crafts has a health trust. So the state of Alaska is also fairly fragmented in how we deliver health insurance to our employees.
So this is a bigger issue than just with the teachers?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Senator Faircloth?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Dunleavy, as you take this up over the summer, I hope that we take a look at those different entities and look at the rate of return on their assets to see how they're managing that money for their participants.
Through the chair, I would imagine that and a bunch of other questions and issues that we need to research will be done, and hopefully I'll be working closely with aspects of the executive branch, but I'm looking forward to getting some information on these issues. I think it's going to be an exciting summer and an exciting year next year.
You're a sick man.
Mr. Chair, I'm excited too.
That's so great. I can think of other ways to spend my summer, but that's good. I'm glad that you're enthused and anxious to dive into this. Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Barnhill, you gave me some numbers a while ago, and I missed out one of them. You had 18,300 school employees, 47,000 state employees. How many dependents were there?
Mr. Chair. So 18,300 school district employees, 29,000 school district dependents, 18,000 plus 29,000 is 47,300 school district population. So that's employees plus dependents.
So the total is 47,000.
47,300.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. And again, yeah, this has potential to be. This has potential to be a big savings to the state. So I'm glad that you're willing to take the time and effort to dive into this, Senator Dunleavy. Okay, well, good. Let's then set this aside for now. Just for some informational purposes here, we do want to take up the trust bill again. The conference committee has been canceled. I did talk to a couple members that aren't here about moving. Let's see, what's the number on that again?
76.
Yeah. Senate Bill 76.
House Bill.
House Bill 76. Sorry, there wasn't any objection. Senator Hoffman was kind of toying with an amendment, but. He's okay not making that. Senator Dunleavy was okay with the bill moving from committee. Is there any other discussion that? Okay, no glasses. Okay, Senator Olson, did you?
No, I haven't. I'm willing to go and get it out here.
Okay. Well, yeah. When I heard that it could potentially cost our employees $378 or something if we didn't. Get in compliance, I felt like we should probably move it. So if there's no objections to that, Senator Faircloth.
Mr. Chairman, I move CS for House Bill number 76, Finance 28-GH1494/P from committee with attached fiscal notes and individual committee recommendations.
Okay. Any objections? Hearing none, the bill moves out of committee. I appreciate the committee members for being flexible with us these last few days here. Session things are... Things are pretty fluid and moving around, and so we're just all trying to keep up. So with that, we do have a meeting tomorrow at 9. We do have some important bills in the morning. House Bill 180 is the Military Youth Academy. HCR 6 seems to be pretty important to the sponsor. It's one we heard on the unmanned aircraft and establishing a task force. And I think that is...
That's it, right?
Okay. That's all we know of for now. So see you bright and early in the morning. With that, we're adjourned till 9 o'clock.